From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Latinos make up a huge part of the movie-going audience, but Hollywood isn't doing them any favors. Then a new documentary where gymnasts and other survivors of Larry Nassar's sexual abuse speak out to provoke change.
Laws were changed because of this, especially in Michigan, laws were changed. Like, this is the start of such a unique ripple effect. This is the beginning, and we are only going forward from here.
And that Netflix docuseries about serial killer Ted Bundy has a lot going on in its score that makes it extra creepy. All that coming up on The Frame. The fight for inclusion and better representation in Hollywood has seen some recent victories. Hollywood's first big studio movie with an all-Asian cast in 20 years, Crazy Rich Asians, was a huge hit. Films like Black Panther and Get Out were heralded both for who got to make and star in them and how well they did at the box office. But we can't quite say the same when it comes to Latino representation in casting and in the stories that Hollywood chooses to tell. According to the latest data, Latinos make up 24% of frequent moviegoers, far more than the percentage of the population, but barely 5% of speaking parts in movies. I spoke with Mia Galupo, who recently wrote about the issue for The Hollywood Reporter. She began by explaining why studios aren't compelled to focus on Latinos on screen, despite how many of them go to the movies.
Reporting out this story, the thing that stuck out to me the most and the thing that I heard over and over again is studios don't necessarily feel incentivized to program to Hispanic audiences because they are considered a sure thing at the box office. They will show up to the movies no matter who's on screen. So there is a studio perception that we do not necessarily need to cater to this audience because they will show up no matter what. What was interesting and what was pointed out to me by one studio exec is that African-American audiences will show up more for movies with African-American casts made by African-American creators, and that necessarily has not been proven with Hispanic audiences. But also, at the same time, they have had less of an opportunity to prove that because there is less Latinx narratives on screen that are consistently coming out from the studios.
Yeah, there's a movie opening this week. It's called El Chicano. It's directed by Ben Hernandez-Bray, and his producer, Joe Carnahan, has talked about how difficult it was to find anybody who would back the movie. And is that kind of typical for those kinds of stories that no studio or I guess even independent distributor is willing to get on board?
In studios, there is not a lot of Latinx representation in executive positions. So when these creatives are going in to pitch these movies, they are pitching to white creatives who may not understand the nuances of the story or the audience potential. But on top of that, movie making has changed in recent years. They are looking more for high concept features. You know, it's superhero movies, it's the sci-fi features that are doing well. And there is a push for inclusion in those parts, but it hasn't necessarily been seen in terms of Latinx representation yet.
Yeah, and I would say it's not limited to that. Nina Jacobson, who produced Crazy Rich Asians, and the intellectual property there was a novel called Crazy Rich Asians. She says that when she was shopping it around, there was at least one producer who said, "I have to ask, does she have to be Asian?" And of course, the answer was yes, and the movie ended up being a huge hit. So how much of that is kind of institutional resistance to taking on this kind of material? Because there's always this bias that Hollywood wants to make these stories that are about non-white characters and make them white. And there's certainly scores of stories about casting doing the exact same thing.
Yeah, so I was talking to Dr. Ana Cristina Ramon, who is one of the researchers who works on UCLA's diversity report, and she made a very interesting point where a preconceived notion in Hollywood has to be proven correct only once, but it has to be proven wrong a dozen times in order for it to die. So you have to have a Black Panther, you have to have a Crazy Rich Asians before Hollywood wakes up and realizes that representation is not only something that is a moral imperative, but also a business imperative.
We're talking with Mia Galupo, a staff writer at The Hollywood Reporter, about Latinos in Hollywood. I think the other issue is, say, if El Chicano does not do well at the box office this weekend, it's easy for Hollywood to look at that and say, see, these movies don't work, whereas they would never say that about a genre like an action movie if an action movie bombed. So it feels as if each and every one of these movies is somehow a referendum on whether or not this kind of story can work commercially.
That has been a big issue in Hollywood, and there is so much pressure on these individual projects and these individual creatives, where if they don't succeed, they are not only letting down the project, but they are letting down filmmakers who are coming up under them who are from their same culture. So it's almost as if you have a whole culture writing on one movie, and that is incredibly unfair and so much pressure. True quality is being able to try and fail and getting the opportunity to try again, not just being able to try and succeed.
In your article, you quote Lin-Manuel Miranda. A lot of people would know him from Hamilton. And he says, Latino audiences are not a monolith. We come from 32 different countries. So what does that mean in terms of both the opportunity and the challenges of telling stories that come from such a huge swath of the globe?
Yeah, so when you look at a movie like Crazy Rich Asians, it is based in one Asian culture and one story, but multiple cultures can identify with it. And a lot of Asian moviegoers went out to see it from across cultures, whether they be Korean or Chinese or Japanese. So the same could happen for Hispanic moviegoers. Actually, people are pointing to Lin-Manuel Miranda's upcoming movie In the Heights as a possible Crazy Rich Asians-esque moment, where it is based on his musical, and it's a story that's set in a musical that's set in Washington Heights, and it tells a Puerto Rican narrative, but has so much Latinx representation that multiple cultures will be able to identify with the narrative.
Mia Galupo is a staff writer at The Hollywood Reporter. Mia, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, a documentary looks at the young women who were assaulted by Larry Nassar and how they have reclaimed their lives. A quick warning that our next conversation deals with the sexual assault of young women and girls. So if you want to step away or skip ahead, it'll be about 11 minutes. A year ago in January, 156 women and girls appeared in a Michigan courtroom and told their stories as survivors of one man's sexual abuse. Larry Nassar was a doctor who worked with the U.S. Olympic gymnastics team and Michigan State University. Over decades, he sexually abused hundreds of young women and girls who were his patients. He was arrested and pled guilty to the sexual assault of minors, leading to that January 2018 sentencing hearing where one by one, survivors spoke out in the courtroom. Sarah Gibson is the executive producer of the film, and Melody Vanderveen is one of the survivors. She's a former dancer who became a patient of Nassar at age 13 and was abused by him for years. Sarah and Melody joined us at KPCC, and we began with why Sarah wanted to tell this story.
So I was a competitive gymnast, and I'm a big gymnastics fan during the Olympics, and I'm a mother. And when I started reading the headlines that there was an abuse problem inside the sport, sort of beyond the usual sort of Caroli, Dominic Marciano abuse story, I was just brokenhearted.
And that's a physical abuse. That's not a sexual abuse and assault.
Correct. I mean, Dominic Marciano would talk about, you know, just the sort of the brutality of the coaching methods, just, you know, training through injuries, training through fatigue. And the abuse in the sport sort of moved beyond that at a certain point and became, you know, I think, full of predators. And reading the early stories about the doctor being investigated in the sport, and I just thought these poor, incredible athletes representing their country going through physical pain and now sexual abuse, it just seemed so cruel. And I just needed to tell the story as a filmmaker. So I actually went to Alex Gibney's office in New York where I was finishing a film. And he said, you need to get Erin Lee Carr to direct that. She brings this radical empathy to everything she does as a journalist and a filmmaker.
Melody, people who were victims of Larry Nassar have so many things that they go through. One is the attack itself, surviving it. Two is the decision to come forward. Three, testify at his sentencing. And then four, you get a call about a documentary film. So when you think about that last step and about what it means to keep talking, how did you decide it was something that you needed to do? And what compelled you to want to be a part of this movie?
Well, a few things. At sentencing, there were loads of different people wanting interviews, and almost it felt like we were being preyed upon by the media. And I get that they wanted to cover this story, but, you know, as Sarah talked about this radical empathy, I didn't see that present sometimes in the interviews. And then I get this email from my lawyer describing that they want to do this documentary, and it felt like a lot more appropriate way to share our story. And so that was the first piece. And second, that I didn't want the sentencing to be the end. There's a lot more that needs to continue happening, and a great way to push this momentum even further is through a documentary. And so this felt fitting for me to be a part of.
Sarah, you are obviously talking to these women, some of whom are very young, about an unspeakable thing that they're speaking about what has happened to them. So how do you make sure that they feel safe talking to you, and that you are listening to what they're saying and making sure that what they want to talk about is what you want to talk about?
Well, I would say the first thing we did as a filmmaking team was try and load up the set with as many women as possible, down to the sound recordists and the camera operators. We just had a set that was 80% women at all times, and it really created a safe space for these women. They walked into this sort of gentle environment where, you know, especially me as a parent, felt very, like, you know, parental and caring to some of these teenagers that were coming in and bearing their souls, and knowing that we were going to take care of them.
Melody, one of the things that is important in this story is that you, along with more than 150 other survivors of Larry Nassar's attacks, gets a chance to speak at his sentencing, a victim impact statement. I want to play a moment where you talk about the importance of shedding a light on the issue of abuse.
It starts with shifting the minds of both men and women who are taught to focus on and protect themselves first. Every time one person does not speak with the truth, another person will be hurt in profound ways. My life is proof of this statement.
And that gets to one of the bigger ideas about this movie, and that is that these women were not believed. There were reports about Larry Nassar for years, and nobody did anything, or they did the wrong thing. So you're talking, really, I think, about what needs to change in terms of going forward, about the way that victims of sexual assault are taken at their word.
Yeah, it is very important to me. I felt that, you know, when I went in to make this victim impact statement, I didn't just want to, you know, delve into all these details of this horrific, you know, reality that I've gone through. I wanted to talk about what are we going to do now. Laws were changed because of this, especially in Michigan, laws were changed. Like, this is the start of such a unique ripple effect. This is the beginning, and we are only going forward from here.
We're talking with Sarah Gibson, the executive producer of the documentary At the Heart of Gold, and Melody Vanderveen, who is one of the survivors. I want to ask about language, because I think it's easy for people to use, including me, the word victim as opposed to survivor.
Yes.
So when you think about words that are right and wrong, and words that I might use rightly and wrongly, what are the words that you like to hear, and why are they important?
So victim is used usually for criminal cases. So victim is in police reports, but we don't need to use the word victim in the media, because as a survivor, as I continue to read articles and I keep seeing the word victim, 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 how does that translate into my brain? It's not healthy. And so I think the media, especially, and anyone relating these types of stories, have to be very careful and understand they're not police. Thus, maybe victim isn't an appropriate word anymore.
Sarah, Larry Nassar didn't do what he did in a vacuum. He was aided and abetted by other people who either knew what he was doing and looked the other way, or didn't look closely enough, or knew and tried to discredit the people who said he was doing something wrong. I want to play the final impact statement at his sentencing. This is Rachel Den Hollander.
When institutions create a culture where a predator can flourish unafraid, this is what it looks like. It looks like a courtroom full of survivors who carry deep wounds. Women and girls who carry scars that will never fully heal, but who have banded together to fight for themselves because no one else would do it.
That's an amazing line. No one else would do it. And she talks about a culture where a predator can flourish. And obviously, Larry Nassar is not the only pedophile out there. He's not the only sexual abuser out there. But there are so many people who could have stopped him who didn't.
Well, they put money before humans. MSU.
That's Michigan State?
Yeah. Michigan State treated Larry Nassar like their prize racehorse. He was their number one spokesperson for fundraising. He was the Olympic doctor. They were going to do everything to protect him. He was making them money. And USOC, USAG, they all turned a blind eye as well. It was money and medals over humans. Slowly, we see justice happening, but it's slow. But I think that this case will hopefully be a lesson to many universities, colleges, institutions across the country that you can't get away with this stuff anymore.
What about you, Millie, in terms of watching the film and hearing people talk about what you and a lot of people you knew went through? What is it like to relive that in hearing about what Larry actually did in his basement or did in his office?
Well, hearing about it again, you know, on film, I never felt that it was going into a gruesome detail where I had to step back. And so I felt actually at peace watching it because I felt that we were esteemed. I was on the winning side. And so I really felt leaving the film quite confident and empowered. And I hope that that's what people get from it, that if you continue to speak up and if you partner with those who are willing to do the right thing, you know, eventually that outcome will happen. And I think that message came through without those ugly details.
Sarah, you end the movie with a young survivor of Larry Nassar's returning to gymnastics. It's a sport that she loves, but obviously it has very bad connotations because it was through the sport that Larry Nassar hurt her. Why was it important to end the movie that way?
Well, we were really focused on ending the film on a triumphant note for the sport itself and really wanted to remind the audience how beautiful the sport is and how positive it can be. So when Chelsea Zerfass agreed to participate in our film, she had quit gymnastics. She had, you know, real talent, and it just broke her. And after the sentencing, she decided she was going to return to the sport, and we were there to document her return. And last time I saw her in Michigan, she had two taped up ankles, and I said, "Wow, you've been doing a lot of gymnastics." And she said, "Yeah," and she seemed so happy.
Sarah Gibson is the executive producer of At the Heart of Gold. Melody Vanderveen is a survivor of Larry Nassar's abuse. Melody and Sarah, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks.
At the Heart of Gold premieres tonight on HBO. Coming up on The Frame, the making of a creepy score for an eerie documentary series featuring the voice of serial killer Ted Bundy. The serial killer Ted Bundy is the subject of two projects on Netflix right now, and they're both directed by Joe Berlinger. One is a narrative film called Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil and Vile. It stars Zac Efron as the charismatic sociopath. The other is Conversations with a Killer, the Ted Bundy tapes. That's a documentary series using never-before-heard interviews with Bundy, recorded while he was on death row. It's a deep dive into the mind of the man who brutally assaulted and murdered more than 30 women and girls in the 1970s. Composer Justin Mellon wrote the music for Conversations with a Killer. Frame contributor Tim Grieving visited him in his studio to hear how he scored the story of a modern-day monster who fascinated a nation.
Hi, my name is Justin Melland, and I wrote the score for Conversations with a Killer, the Ted Bundy tapes.
I've never spoken to anybody about this. I am looking for an opportunity to tell the story as best I can.
When I started to think about this score, there was so much of Ted's voice in it, And I realized, oh my God, I can cut out some of it and just start manipulating it and use it the way I do in my experimental music. I mean, I realize it's creepy, but I definitely didn't have any reservations about using it. It was a purely like a sculpture kind of decision. If you go through the Ted Bundy tapes, hearing his voice for 4 hours, and then you hear this again, you'll be able to recognize it, even though it's totally scrambled.
There's nothing in my background which would lead one to believe that I was capable of committing murder.
There is a bit of a sing-song quality to it. It's also very soothing, and that's what's probably the creepiest thing.
Some people perceive me as being shy and introverted. I didn't go to dances, I didn't go on the beer drinking outings, and I was a pretty, you might call me straight, but not a social outcast in any way.
He sounds like he must just be very relaxed and happy, and which is why it works so well in this context where the music is not really ever very soothing, but we can open it up into spaces that are less than completely full of tension and then put that voice in there and it adds a whole other dimension of creep. I just started looking through, and I think it only took me 3 different moves of the pointer to find something crazy, which was that he said, "Still, for me, I'd always maintained an undercurrent of optimism."
That things would turn out the way they should turn out.
And I'm like, oh, that's genius. You know, you put that as this, like, rhythmic component in a piece that is very driving and aggressive and kind of saying the exact opposite. So then what I did was I put it into a special module on this modular synth wall behind you that's made to change the speed and the direction of the file that's being played. You can also do a thing called granulating, which is to break it up into small little pieces, and then you can actually pitch shift the small pieces as well. And you can also send it rhythmic values that can make your manipulations rhythmic and they can fit to a beats per minute tempo. We need to start with a kind of pastoral vibe so that we can feel the innocence of the part of him that first of all, that he believes is innocent, and second, that for a while he kind of was innocent. So what I did at first was I took his voice and then I laid it in rhythmically, and then I played a guitar part, an electric guitar part. I wanted to evoke something like you would hear on a 70s electronic experimental music album that was the chill out part, you know? And so like maybe something from Pink Floyd. That's why I use the electric guitar, and I use a guitar from the 70s. It's an old Silvertone. I played it through an RE201 Space Echo, which is also a 70s reverb echo unit. And then also behind it is a 70s string machine called a Krumar. And then we go into the dark turn of the piece, which is, you know, the monster part. And so there's 2 things that are happening with Ted's voice there. There's the thing that we've been doing before, which is the rhythmic manipulation. Sounds like that. And then there is a part where I ran it. Yeah, where I ran it through a space echo and got the space echo itself resonating. And so you can't really tell this is Ted, but I got disturbed after a while working on it. I also got disturbed when I would feel empathy for him because, say, I was spending a couple hours on a part that where he's really sad, like legitimately really sad, or legitimately wishing that he wasn't an evil serial killer. And then you can kind of like feel sorry for the poor monster, you know? And so that was always weird. Like, I can't feel this, but you know, it's a story of human suffering. So, you know, it's easy to appeal to the emotion of anyone working on it. I have to score the monster in a way that makes you see that he's a multifaceted being. So if I just score one aspect of him, we won't have much of a story.
That was composer Justin Mellon deconstructing his score for the Netflix docuseries Conversations with a Killer, The Ted Bundy Tapes. And that is it for The Frame this week. I'm John Horn. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back on Monday.